Today we want to discuss the implication of this word, person. So Prabhupada says, I can't find it exactly, it's somewhere in the Krishna book, I think. But he says, to say that the Absolute is a person means that the Absolute has senses. That's the meaning of person, that you have senses. And he said other things along the line. So I take this as the definition of a person, or a essential characteristic. What we mean by person is that it has senses. So when somebody says, what do you mean when you say God is a person? We mean that he has senses. Because immediately you understand that you establish a subject-object relationship. Because senses implies there's a subject, and there's objects, and there's a process of perception or interaction between the subject and the object. So, and that's, then you have a person. But let's look at some more of the implications. So the first thing is that subject-object is there. Remember, Tillich had great problems with subjects and objects. But subject-object relationship is there. Now, what is meant by senses? Well, in the Vedic definition, the word for senses is indriya, right? And there's two classes of indriya. Karmendriya and Gyanendriya. Not to be confused with Karma, Gyana, and Bhakti in our our little typology. So Karmendriya means senses for acting on the world, and Gyanendriya means senses for receiving knowledge. Now usually in the West when they say senses, they say there are five senses. And they mean the five Gyanendriya. A sense of sight, sense of touch, sense of taste, sense of smell. What did I leave out? Sense of hearing. Right? These are the five Gyanendriya. And the Karmendriya are also five. A sense is for manipulation. I'm going to make them a little more abstract in hands because they apply it other than you. Senses for manipulation, right? Or instruments. I like to use the word instruments, you know. Because we always think of the word senses as applying just to Gyanendriya. So really they're instruments. Instruments for hearing, instruments for tasting, instruments for touching. They're instruments. So similarly, instruments for manipulating objects, instruments for locomotion, legs, instruments for sound production, tongue. The tongue is the one that shows up in both categories. The only one. Then instruments for reproduction and evacuation. Those are the indriya. Plus, we also include the mind as the 11th sense. Sometimes it's included. Right? So in the subject-object relationship, what this implies then is that there's a person who has instruments for Karmendriya for acting on the world and Gyanendriya for the world to act back on him for receiving. So it's a two-way relationship here like this, you know. With the Karmendriya you manipulate things in the world, the Gyanendriya you receive information back from the world. If you want a fancy word, by the way, that's there in Western in psychology, these are called cognitive senses, for senses for cognition, and these are called conative, C-O-N-A-T-I. I think I use them in this, in these essays, conative senses. So the terminology is already there, cognitive, conative. And I don't know if I can spell it now. I'm not sure if that's an A or an I. It's hard to spell, especially when you have it's an A. Yeah. So if that's what we mean by senses, then we can understand another definition of Prabhupada, that a body is a collection of sense organs. That's really what a body is. It's just an arrangement of sense organs, particular arrangement of sense organs. So then we can see that has senses, you know, that implies that body has a body. Because that's what a body is. It's just a collection of sense, organized collection of sense organs. Right? So just from this definition, the Absolute has senses, do we understand that entails that He has a body? Right? So then we can go a little further. Body means what else? Well, as I said before, if there's senses in a body, then there's also sense objects. And there has to be a field for this body to operate. So there's sense objects. And all the sense objects taken together and in some kind of unified field is an environment. As to say, a world, huh? The so-called external world. So we're talking about a spiritual person with spiritual senses, which means a spiritual body, which means a spiritual world. He's got his own environment. So then from this definition, we deduce a spiritual world too. A spiritual environment, spiritual senses, and so on. So all we're doing is taking this definition and kind of unpacking it and seeing what the implications are. What we're trying to do is explain to people, Mayavadis, other people, someone who's come to our temple, and their experience is, we say God is a person. And what do they see on the altar? Well, they see, Gornitai, Jagannath Balaram Subhadra, Radha Krishna. Sometimes they see Panchatattva. Sometimes they see Sita Ram. Sometimes they see Radha Krishna and Lalita and Vishaka. You know, a whole crowd of people up there. And they want to know what we mean by person. And they're thinking of, you know, Jagannath's big eyes and Radha and Krishna. And he's black and she's white. And they're trying to figure out what's going on, you know. And they're wearing clothes and garlands and, you know. So we're going to have to get to all that to make them understand. See, the whole point of this is to explain that what we're doing, which to them looks so far out, amazing, if not crazy, actually is entirely reasonable. So that's what we start with, this definition, has senses. And we get all this. We get the whole spiritual world coming out of here. Okay, now let's keep going. Because we're going to try to understand what kind of a person is it that God is. When we say, actually what I'm trying to do today is spell out some of the import of the word Krishna. When we say Krishna, what is actually meant? And if you reject God, or if you reject Krishna as God, you should understand what you're rejecting. Okay, so we've gotten so far now. Now, the idea of a person also seems to have with it, as we see here in this material world, that there's interaction with other people. So far as we know, persons don't exist in isolation. And we've been told this about Krishna, that Krishna is never by himself. Prabhupada said that. He rejects sometimes these pictures that you see Krishna. That sort of comes close there, where you see Krishna without any other, you know, cows or peacocks or gopis or cowherd boys. This is, at least Vrindavan's there, but sometimes, you know, there's just a shining sphere, an Om sign, and Krishna's in the middle with his flute. Prabhupada said that's impersonal. Krishna, he says, is never alone. He's never by himself. He's always in the association of his devotees. Hmm? Yeah, so that's how you get out of it. You say the flute's a devotee. So if you have that picture, you can keep it. So other people are there. So that means another implication of person is other people interacting or social. And what we see, at least in the presentation we have, that a personal conception of God is preeminently a social conception of God. So this environment that we've deduced is full of people, other people. Gopis, cowherd boys, mother, father, all these relationships are there. Social, you know, social means relationships. And we understand that these relationships are very important to Krishna, so much that he very much likes having names that have names of his devotees in them. Yashoda Nandana, Devaki Nandana, Parthasarathi. He likes these names. So that when he's never by himself, means that Krishna's actually, what he is constituted by these relationships. These are internal relationships. These are happening in the internal potency. And so from all this we deduce the kingdom of God. Krishna is a person and therefore he has his kingdom and the internal potency through which he creates this kingdom, his own ideal environment where all these relationships take place. Now of course, so far as we see, when people mean God, what they mean by God is the Ishwara. And they particularly talk about God means, as far as they're concerned, the one who creates the world and controls the world. In other words, the Lord of the material world. That's God. That's the general idea that people have, something about God. All this, what we have seen, takes place in the internal potency. But the idea of God simply deals with external potency. But Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, when I'm dealing with the external potency, he says that is a single fragment of myself, an amsha, meaning the supersoul. He says, I do all this, I deal with the external potency by a little fragment of myself, by the supersoul. What shloka? Does anybody know the number? What is it? 10:42. No. Yeah, Akam. Yes, that's right. What was the next? I don't know. Ekam Shena something. Yeah. Stitoji. Yeah. Ekam Shena Stitoji Gat. I maintain Stita, this Jagat, Ekam Shena, by one fragment of myself. Yes, the final verse. What is the use of describing all these glories to you with a single fragment of myself? So that single fragment is what most people know by as God. That's Krishna dealing with his external potencies. Well, we don't see a whole lot there that's really personal as we've just described it. An environment. I mean, that's the inferior external potency. Krishna needs his own environment. So he has his internal potency. So, a long time ago, Jayadvaita Maharaj wrote an essay in Back to Godhead magazine in which he says, Krishna is God, he says, but the idea of Krishna is greater than the idea of God. So here's Tillich's God beyond God, really, that he's looking for. The idea of Krishna is greater than the idea of God. He's making the same point, that God is just someone who... God is an office. It's a position. It's a job. But Krishna is the person, that's his job. And he dispatches it, Eka Amshena, by means of one Amsha of himself. But meanwhile, he's got a lot more interesting things to do. And that's in his dealings with the internal potency. And this is what nobody else, so far as I know, has much to say about. If anyone else in any other religious tradition knows about it, they aren't talking. They're raising their fingers and smiling mysteriously. We don't know what they know. I doubt they know this. If you actually know this, then you talk like crazy. So the idea of Krishna, he says, is greater than the idea of God. So what happens is that in the internal potency, or when we start to deal with Krishna, where these relationships develop, there's varieties and differentiated sorts of relationships. Why does Krishna... Because then, see, people want to know. Well, look, you look on the altar, there's Jagannath, Balaram, Subhadra, Radha, Krishna, Gaur Nitai. And then they start looking at the pictures on the wall, you know. There's this boar, there's this fish, there's this guy, you know, chopping people to bits. There's this half man, half lion, you know, all this. And we're strict monotheists, right? No, this is the same Krishna. But for different varieties of relationships, he aspects different features. He reveals or shows different aspects of himself. I usually use this word, aspects. And Prabhupada gives an example. And especially with this notion of God, not only is the notion of God is dealing with the external potency, but there's also the notion of God on the model of royalty. Grandeur, power, Aishvarya. That's the Sanskrit word. Another word that's associated with God. Aishvarya. Comes from Ishwara, Aishvarya. Opulence, lordship, the condition of being the Ishwara, the controller. Aishvarya. So then we have Krishna, who's this, you know, there's no Aishvarya. So how do you have all these different aspects? Some majestic, then there's Krishna, then there's Ramchandra, all this thing. There's different relationships and different aspects. So say somebody, but we see that here in the human being. Here's an ordinary human being. And yet that person has different roles that he plays, different aspects. Let's use this word role. Everybody knows about role playing, right? Different social, personal, and political roles. So one of his roles is, say, he's a judge. High court judge. So you dress differently for that. You know, in America, they put on a black robe. Other places, not only put on this black robe, but they bury their head under these monstrous wigs. They do that in Australia? They still do like that. They have these monstrous wigs they put on, you know. Because you costume, you know, it's a different role, and so you dress in a certain way. So here's a person who's the judge in the court, and everybody treats him with deference and respect. In America, they say, Your Honor. I think in England, in the crown colonies that never had a revolution, they say, My Lord. My Lord. Lord. That's what they say in the movies anyway. I've never been in an English court. And you treat him with deference and respect, you know. When the judge comes in, you have to stand up. You have to take your hat off, too. The guy will go, take your hat off, you know. Yeah. Have to doff your hat, you know. Oh, you still don't have to bow yet. And in that courtroom, the judge has certain amount, an immense amount of power. He can instantly put anyone in jail in America for something called contempt of court. They even like put lawyers in jail right away, right on the bat. And the lawyer gets too contradictory or contrary, he'll like put him in jail. He can do it. He has the power once you're in that court. So everybody's very deferential, very respectful, my lord. Very powerful. So then the guy goes home, he takes off his robes, you know, he walks into his home. Nobody calls him Your Honor, my lord. Hi, it's, you know, Dad, Bill, whatever, you know. Now the relationships become familiar. They become different. So at home, he has a whole other set of relationships, which maybe a prisoner in the dock would find hard to understand, or the lawyer, and the lawyers may actually treat him differently. When they're in the court, they treat him one way. Then afterwards, they go to a bar and have a drink together. They treat each other in a different way. So, according to your social relationships, so say one person, part of his job, he can be a judge in the court, and he's treated one way. And then, to a typically fashion, he also is a professor in a law school. So then he has students, and then there's another set of relationships. Still a little formal, but not as formal. He can't put any of his students in jail, although he can flunk them. So the element of awe and reverence is a little reduced. Then he has his buddies. He goes out on camping trips or fishing trips and stuff else. They goof around, they play around. Then he has his kids, he has his wife, you know. So Prabhupada used an example like this. So we sustain a variety of relationships. A lot of times we change our costumes we wear for the different relationships that we have, whether you dress formally or casually, you put on special things, you know, robes, gowns, uniforms, so on like that. So this we see in human society. Generally with us, because we're limited human beings, there's a limit to how many variety of roles we can sustain before we lose our integrity. But we want to keep it together as one integrated person and yet play all these roles. But there's usually a limit to what we can do. And there's some things we can't do because we can't reconcile it with other things that we do sometimes. It's too contradictory. But now we're talking about God. So we can expect lots of varieties of roles in his case, some of them appearing very contradictory, and yet because he's the Supreme Lord, he's supremely integrated and unified, he holds them all together. So if he's the Supreme Person, and we're little people, and we have these different relationships in which we play different roles and different aspects of ourselves become manifest, So that one man can be father, husband, teacher, judge, whatever, so many things. What about God? He's the Supreme Person. So therefore, we get disclosed from Him so many different roles and so many different relationships. And therefore He's Krishna, therefore He's Balaram, therefore He's Narayan, therefore He's Nisringa, therefore He's Vamana, therefore He's... and so on. So many different roles. Now some of them are very playful when He takes animal forms and things like that. But also it's not written anywhere in stone that God can't have a sense of humor, a sense of fun, a sense of play. Friedrich Nietzsche is supposed to have said, you know, I could believe in a God who could dance. He thought there was no such thing. You know, he thought God was stuffy. But He's not stuffy at all. So He can dance. And He has a sense of fun. So if He wants to, you know, for the business of, you know, bringing the earth out of the muck, He says, well, I'll take the form of a boar. Why not? That's the appropriate form for doing this. I'll appear as a boar. And because people are shocked by this, you know. Ah, it's amazing. They say, yeah, that's right, God's amazing. You think because you're amazed it can't be God? No. If you're amazed, it means it's more likely to be God. You think God has to be limited to the compass span of some shopkeeper's understanding? Of course you should be amazed. He is amazing. So therefore He has all these different roles and all these different relationships. So, among them, some are more intimate and some are less intimate. So one thing, we have this feature of God as Narayan, where this Aishvarya is displayed, you know, the four-handed Narayan form of God. So as Narayan, or as Vishnu, the Lord's majesty overpowers His beauty. And there's always awe and reverence. But as Krishna, the Lord's beauty overpowers His majesty. And this is where we get the revelation of Krishna Himself. This is the place where Krishna says, you know, it's like the judge who goes home and takes off his robes and he just wants to relax and not be on display, not represent the commonwealth or the government. So Krishna is the private life of God. This is what He does when He's not being God. When He's just being Himself. Because He wants to also enjoy intimate relationships. He has to have everything that we have. That's a good thing. He should have too, only in superabundance. So we like close, intimate relationships. There's no close, intimate relationships in a courtroom. If they are, they have to be suppressed because of the formality and solemnity of the occasion. The judge has to represent the grandeur and majesty of the government. So there's no intimate relationships. If his wife happens to be in the courtroom and she happens to want to say something to him in public, she also has to say, Your Honor. Yeah. That's the etiquette. The decorum is required like that. But so Krishna has a place where he can just relax and enjoy intimate exchanges of love without the awe and reverence, grandeur, majesty, all that stuff that get in the way. So that's Vrindavan. So all this is required by the idea of a person who sustains personal relationships and wants to enjoy the widest variety of relationships. He has to have the most intimate, informal, close relationships. So therefore Mother Yashoda, therefore the cowherd boys, therefore Radharani and the gopis. If he doesn't have these things, then he's not the greatest. He'd be bereft in some way. So we have these revelation like this. We have the revelation of Radha and Krishna. which is the most intimate aspect of the private life of God. And that's why it's also, it's confidential. It's Krishna's private affairs. But through the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, we have some access to this, these private affairs of Krishna. But to actually enter into them and to appreciate them, you have to be very, very pure and very elevated. So out of all these relationships, they're relationships, they're ongoing, they develop, they're dynamic. And Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami explains in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Prabhupada also explained, I remember the first time I heard this was in a lecture in New Vrindavan. He was looking at the deities and he says that Krishnadas Kaviraj also explains like this, that this is where Prabhupada gets it from. He says that Krishna looks at Radharani and he sees that she's beautiful and he becomes engladdened. And because he becomes engladdened, his beauty increases. And when Radharani sees that Krishna's beauty is increased, her joy increases and her beauty increases. So Krishna sees that she's become more beautiful, so his joy increases and his beauty increases. Then she sees and so on, he says, without any end. So notice, increasing. Here we are in the transcendental realm, but actually it's not static. But it's always increasing. And how does it increase? Out of the interaction between persons, back and forth. That's what increases. It's not just kind of automatically growing, but out of this interaction that it's increasing. Yeah, well, Krishna's increasing. His beauty is ever increasing. His bliss is ever increasing. And naturally, his knowledge has to keep increasing because he knows these things as they increase. So everything increases. He's always increasing. And then furthermore, actually, even more intimate in this affair of Radha and Krishna, or right at the middle of it, is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Because that represents the aspect of Krishna trying to take Radharani's position. Krishna trying to understand himself, see himself, and appreciate himself the way that Radharani does, and also to appreciate Radharani. It's Lord Chaitanya is Krishna's ultimate tribute to devotional service, that he wants to be a devotee. He thinks it's better than being God. So Lord Chaitanya is the eternal feature in the relationship between Radha and Krishna, of Krishna trying to understand himself. What is it about me that Radharani finds so attractive? She seems to be enjoying more bliss than I do. I want to taste it for myself. And I want to understand her love for me. So therefore he appears as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So these are all different, this is all the meaning of person. So all of these things, the Leela avatars, Paramatma, Narayan, Krishna, Radha Krishna, Lord Chaitanya. Even in Krishna Leela, the ascending level of intimacy, Dwarka, Mathura, Vrindavan, getting higher and higher and higher toward more and more intimate relationships. All this, Krishna in all these different aspects, all his different incarnations, all that is what we mean by Krishna. God is great. So this is our idea of what we mean by great. Now, do you have an idea of anyone greater? A light? A white light? Some inert, featureless, empty, barren desert is greater than that? Some impersonal something is greater than Krishna now. So, Prabhupada says people have been taught that God is great, but they don't know how great God is. So here we have the complete description of what it means to say that God is a person. And we take the idea of person as an individual with senses and environment, social being, personal relationships. And we see that Krishna is what fits the bill. So then you look at these other things, not only the Mayavadi description, but you look at, say, William James, a mental personality. You know, how limp can you get? Obviously God can't be a mental personality, or a God who sustains no relationships, or even a God. There was a movie that was made years and years ago in England. It was one of the early movies of I forgot what they're called now. Some big comic team, you know. Not the Goons, afterwards. Monty Python, I think. Some of those people. And it was about a guy who sold his soul to the devil. He got all these different promises and they kept getting screwed up. So the devil is the character in this movie. And the guy, one of the episodes, he says to the devil, look, you know, you were in heaven, everything was fine, you know. He says, you know, why did you turn against, why are you the devil? And the guy says, look, you know, and there's one of these lampposts or something there. And so the devil starts walking around, circumambulating the lamppost like this, going, holy, 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 holy. He says, you want to do that for all eternity? He said, you want to quit too. So people's idea of the kingdom of God, you know, is that it's such a boring place. Because they don't have any idea of social relationships. All the interesting people are in hell. That's what Mark Twain said. That was his famous quip, you know, heaven for climate, hell for society. That all the people that went to church were so boring and lifeless. And then all the interesting people, you know, they had cigars in their mouth and were playing cards and drinking whiskey. It's heaven for climate, hell for society. All this, you know, part of these very limp ideas of God and ideas of spiritual life. So notice when we say that God has relationships, or another way to put it is to say He has relatives, right? And we get back to this other word, relativity. So what we're saying, the personal idea of God implies relativity in God. And we'll just add this little prefix. Didn't leave enough room. Transcendental relativity. This phrase I found in Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, so it's bona fide. It's implied anyway, but he actually uses the phrase. In Krishna, it's person means relationships. He said he has relatives. So there's also relativity in Krishna. No, to have relative means what you are depends on other things. Usually when you say relative things, we mean things that whose existence depends on something else. Something is absolute, we say his existence depends only on itself. But if we get back originally to this paradigm, you know, we had karma, jnana, and bhakti, three phases of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. So what happens is that theologians tend to proceed on a principle of invidious contrast. You set up a pair of contrasts. And you say one side is good and the other side is bad. So here, you know, relative. That's bad. Here's absolute. That's good. Absolute means no relativity, you know. Here's many or variety. That's bad. What's good is one. You put a capital O on it. Unity. All right. Activity. Let's see. Action. That's bad. Inaction. That's good. Concrete. Specific. Abstract. That's good. Speech. Silence. And so on. You see? So you get a whole list of terms, you know, contrasting terms. And you say one side is bad and the other side is good. But what we're saying here in the bhakti, you know, you have both together. There's a supreme, absolute way of being relative. There's a way of being many or having variety that doesn't compromise unity. There's a way of having transcendental action, transcendental specificity and concreteness, transcendental speech, transcendental relationships. See that? Relative. Relationships. Absolute. No relationships, right? Not even relationship to a world. So this is the principle on which they go. One philosopher is called, Charles Hartshorne, calls it the principle of invidious contrast. Invidious. Charles Hartshorne, H-A-R-T-S-H-A-O-R-N-E.
He describes what this...
This system of working. You know, he wants to say God is the you know, divine... He has a book called The Divine Relativity. Of course, he thinks... I mentioned this guy before. He's the one I wrote my doctoral dissertation on. He thinks that, you know, that the relative, ever-increasing... He also has arguments God must always be increasing, but he always thinks that that's the cosmos, you know, cosmic organism in the process of evolution. Because he doesn't know about the internal potency. All he knows is the external potency. So he has to, you know, he deduces certain things about God, you know, by having great arguments against Mayavada philosophy, but then has to apply them to the external potency because he has no knowledge of an internal potency.
Where's he from?
He's an American. Texas. Where he is now, anyway. Still alive. Or maybe died recently, I don't know. He was born the same year as Prabhupada. He's an American theologian. But I just don't want to take credit for his his term, but he points this out, this kind of contrast. So when we say Krishna, we say transcendental relativity. That's what it means to be a person. And that's why it's rejected by the Mayavadis. And that's why God gets reduced down to a nothing. Okay? Anyway, that's what we mean by person. Supreme person. Transcendental person. Questions? I guess he knew how to do it, didn't he? So okay, that was his. He found a way to tell at least tell us about them and about what was going on, without breaking that principle. But what's in Krishna book is just also, if you look at the literature of the six Goswamis, that's just the beginning of it. There's lots more information to the six Goswamis that's not there in Krishna book. And Prabhupada, by writing Krishna book, managed to explain it every step of the way, that you can't take this for material sexual relationships and so on, so that people are warned. Because there's a danger to speaking out about these things, which we see has happened. So many sahajiyas and things like that have sprung up. And that's the danger. That's the risk. But because it's Kali Yuga, at this point, Lord Chaitanya decided to make it accessible to everybody and also give a very, very powerful process for becoming purified so that it can actually be comprehended. If it weren't for Lord Chaitanya, we'd never know. You know, we'd still be thinking spiritual life means you have to keep circumambulating that lamppost going, holy, holy, holy. Yeah.
What's the question?
I like how this in the spiritual world, the stones, for example, are Krishna conscious people. You know, we have a variety of people here. Prabhupada said there's some stones that are alive too, or trees. But trees, not all their senses work. You know, you start off with these are the senses that you have. But animal forms of life and plant forms of life, you shut off switches. Sariputta's case, by the way, is that Krishna, the human form, is the model for all bodies. And that other bodies are made by switching off and distorting the human, switching off parts of the human form and distorting it. That's his case. Because the evolutionists say, like, for example, if you look at the fins of a whale, you see when you x-ray it, you see fingers, finger bones in there. So this is proof that they're originally land animals that went back to the water through a process of evolution. So Sariputta has an argument that if you're a designer, you make basically one design, and then you just modify and change around that design by shutting switches off. And so these vestigial organs and things like that are explained, can be explained perfectly rationally on another basis. So when you see trees, trees don't obviously have, we know that trees are people, even in this material world, trees are living entities. But when you get sinful, you have less and less ability for your senses to act. Some senses don't act, or some senses are, everything is narrowly focused into one sense. Prabhupada said, fish life is all tongue. Because they're living in water, and that stripe up the side of a fish's body has full of taste buds, you know. It's like their bodies are one big tongue. various distortions are there. You know, that's the best way I can understand it. Anything else? Other questions? Yeah?
What you said down here is meditation, do you?
Well, it's coherent. It goes from one to the other. You start. I'm starting with certain definitions. Person means has senses. Now, I'm not arguing that point. I could really get into it with somebody. What do they mean by person? What do I mean by person? There's a whole philosophical literature on what is meant by person. There's one discussion going on in America and England. There's another discussion going on in the continent in different schools of philosophy. And you can spend your whole life just on that topic. But anyway, so I just start with what Prabhupada says. Person means has senses. And from that, everything follows. Now, like any logical argument, you can reject the premise. And if you reject the premise, you always have that option. Any logical argument has premises. And if you don't like the conclusion, reject the premise. And sometimes if you don't like the conclusion, somebody will say, well, the premises are obvious or self-evident. You say, well, it's not self-evident to me. So either you have more arguments to back up the premise or, you know, you part ways. So far as I know, that's more his own idea. Although it's certainly in line with Shastra. Because if Krishna has a human form, that means the human form is not an arbitrary creation evolved out of something. It's somehow rather standard or normative. It's the form that Krishna and his devotees have. For the most part, human forms. And in those human forms, they have their most intimate relationships. So he takes the human form as, you know, the highest standard and the normative, and everything else is a limitation on that. So that's certainly in line with the way you think of things. Yes? So tomorrow I'm going to try to, like, kind of do a quick review and summarize things, and so think over the whole course. Bring up any questions you have, and I also try to make a summary of a variety of arguments we can use. Try to pull together the arguments we have against Mayavada philosophy out of all of this stuff, and especially the different kinds of Mayavada he looked at. Okay. Thank you very much, Lord Prabhupada.